For all my women out there, I just want you to know that you are a boss. Women have to be at the table for technology and innovation. And if not, we'll simply create our own. Don't feel like you shouldn't be a part of the tech space just because there aren't many women in the room. That's exactly why we need you to be there. Girl, don't forget to rep your set in these tech spaces, aka rep your culture. You are the face of technology and the face of the future. This quick commercial, guys, is brought to you by Huawei Technologies. Huawei Technologies is a tech firm that develops small to medium-sized websites for businesses. So if you need a website, reach out to Huawei Technologies. They can be reached at huaweitech.com or shoot them an email at info@huaweitech.com. Thank you, Huawei Technologies, for sponsoring this episode.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Women in Tech with Ariana. It's me, Ariana, your favorite host. Today, guys, I am super excited for our special guest, Christina Perla. Christina is the CEO and founder of MakeLab, and I'm so excited to have her on the show today. So, Christina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Ariana.
Absolutely. So, let's start from the beginning. Christina, where are you originally from and currently based?
So I have a pretty interesting personal story. I was actually adopted from China at the age of 6 months, and I grew up in New Jersey, and currently I'm in New York. I'm in Brooklyn, New York. I came here for college, and I've stayed ever since.
Nice. You know, I love the stories when people are like, oh yeah, you know, I was raised here, went to college, and then like, I never left because I love the city. And then New York is like New York, right? Like you just can't get much better than that outside of like SF and stuff. But New York is New York. So
yeah, I couldn't get away from that hustle vibe. You know, I went to Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, and that's really a place where it's so competitive, and like they really work you there. And so it just, the whole neighborhood is very vibrant as well. So I just was attracted to it, and I decided to stay.
So, you know, so I go to New York quite a bit for conferences and meetings and stuff. And I absolutely love it. I'm originally from Georgia, but my husband's like he's like the typical, like super Southern, like, you know, I want to, you know, he's like, I think the other day he's like, yeah, I want to, you know, buy a ranch for our family and have 50. Yeah, I'm like 50 acre ranch. I'm like, dude, I want to be in a penthouse in New York City or in Atlanta. That's where we're originally from. Like, I don't, like, I love the hustle vibe. So when you talk about, yeah, it's great. But yeah, so Christina, let's talk about your background as a designer. You have a great, amazing resume. When I was doing research on you, I was very like, yes, sis, yes. So you know, you have a history as an industrial designer. You're an accessories designer at Converse, the shoe company. And you even taught middle school students design, to now being the founder of MakeLab, which, you know, eventually we'll get into that and let you explain what MakeLab is. But walk us through your journey of being a designer.
It's so interesting because I think for the longest time, like dating back to grade school, middle school, and high school, I was so interested in math and science. Like that's really where I excelled in out of all the subjects. It was just math and science. And it wasn't until my junior year of high school that I kind of I took an art class because I had to. And I really enjoyed the cathartic processes of art. And then when looking up careers and taking my SATs and everything and just having more pressure to find, you know, quote unquote, what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, the design world really attracted me, specifically industrial design. So I attended Pratt pre-college for architecture, actually. So I was first interested in architecture, then moved to industrial design because that 8 weeks at Pratt pre-college was, I think, the hardest 8 weeks of like my high school career. It was so difficult. It was very much like being on your own and just having a ton of pressure. So, and I didn't fully understand architecture at the time. So then I made the jump to industrial design, and then I had a year basically to get my portfolio together and try to get into Pratt. So that's what I did. I ended up working on my portfolio, I think three, four days a week. For 3 hours at a time. It was a lot of work. And then I got into Pratt, and the first year was like this year called Foundation. So it's very artsy, but then you move more into like, your major, which mine was industrial design. And then I, somewhere, I think my junior year of college, I got an internship at Converse, and I just sort of stayed and I worked until like after college. I was there for a while. And it was interesting. It was very much the fashion world, so I wouldn't say it was, you know, what you would think industrial design is at first. It wasn't consumer products. It was very much fashion. But yeah, I learned a lot about working with vendors overseas, how to communicate with them, and also like what kind of pace you need to move at in that industry. And then somewhere in the middle, I did teach middle school students design. It was like a 3-week workshop I taught with my friend, and we were teaching about the design process. So that was pretty fun.
That's awesome. I love it. Now, Christina, let's talk about the story behind MakeLab. How did it get started? Tell our listeners about what MakeLab is.
So after my time at Converse, I kind of wanted to try something new. I didn't want to be in corporate. I didn't feel like it was the best fit for me. I wanted to, so to speak, like expand my creative wings a little bit. So I found another job working for a wearable tech startup that happened to be run by an old professor of mine at Pratt, and we somehow reconnected, and she was happened to be hiring at that time, and so I ended up getting the position, and I stayed there for about 7 to 8 months, I believe, until I started to get that itchy feeling again of like, you know, I kind of want to try something else. I want to do something more. I want to be in more control. I want to be like closer to my why, and closer, and really feel like I have an effect on things rather than just, you know, working on someone else's project and whatnot. So it was a really quick decision, because once I had that thought, I couldn't get it out of my head. So I eventually gave in my 2 weeks notice, and I started to freelance, and I started to design products and aid with the product development process. I had a profile on Upwork. I had a profile on I don't I'm not sure if it was Fiverr. It might have been Fiverr. But a few other platforms, and I would just accept clients, network, go to events, hand out my business card, and get clients. And during that whole process, somewhere along the lines, I ended up partnering with my fiance Manny, and we were doing it together. And so while we were taking on client projects together, we needed to 3D print quite often. So we found an online supplier that happened, well, we found someone online, but they were located in Bushwick. We became friends with the owner. He was really focused on service. He taught us a lot about 3D printing. And then a year later, he texted me and asked to have a meeting to talk about us acquiring the business, because he was moving out of the country. And so that's how MakeLab started.
Wow, no, that's really cool. I really want to unpack that. So you went from doing your work and stuff at Converse. You got inspired and kind of wanted to branch off and do your own thing. I'm curious to know, so at this time in your life, you're going to different networking events, you're handing out business cards. What do you think was the it factor, or what was it about you or the projects that you've worked on that you felt like made people say, like, hey, I'm gonna go with Christina to help me with this product? What experience was like that for you? And I'm asking that question because there are a lot of folks who listen to the show. I would say 50% are technical, the other 50% aren't. And then 50% of them have startups, and 50% of them are at that point that you were years ago after you left Converse. So what was it about you that you feel like at the time that kind of helped you to get those land those jobs?
I just try to be supportive, really. As a consultant, as a freelancer, you're filling needs. You need to be able to listen to your clients' needs and perform based off of that. They might not know their needs. They might not know how to verbalize their needs, but in some shape or form, you need to figure out what they're looking for and if you can fill that gap for them. So that's what I did. I tried to, within like the first consultation, I always tried to ask questions that, and I did a lot of research on questions to ask in like a first consultation as a freelancer. I just wanted to make sure I got the most information about the prospective project and client and what they were looking for as possible in conversation form while also building a relationship. And that's just something you learn kind of as you go. I would say the first, I don't think I remember my first consultation, but I couldn't imagine it was good by any means. It was probably really rough, really awkward, a lot of long pauses. I probably didn't get everything I needed. Like I'm pretty sure I bombed it. But yeah, I would say it's just a lot about listening and then figuring out where you can fit in and then also how you can charge for it. That's very important, which is also a skill that took some time to learn.
I know exactly what you're hearing that there. And because, you know, I think, and eventually what ends up happening is either you end up, one, people lose their business because they can't afford to keep it up, or two, you put in so much work that one day it just hits you like, I need to charge more. Like I'm putting in way too much and giving too much out there to be charging the prices that I'm charging. So I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. That's like the whole process of learning your value, right? Like I think at first I would approach these meetings and clients with like, oh, I'm young, and just like go down the laundry list of like why I'm not worth what I thought an experienced freelancer was worth, you know, at their hourly rate or a flat fee. But one thing I learned is, no, I might be young, but I know something that they don't. So that automatically gives me value. And if I'm undercharging, I'm not going to do a good job and I'm going to lose that relationship. So if there's a place in the process to risk like charging too high or, you know, any of that, you want to do in the beginning, because you don't want to realize 3/4 of the way through that you're like, you don't want to start feeling like, oh, this isn't worth it. I feel like I might be being taken advantage of, you know, you don't want that. When you're already working, you want to dish all that out in the beginning.
Yes, you do. And it helps you to scale, right? Because when you're charging what you need to charge, you don't need to run yourself into the ground because you can afford to hire other people to help you, right? So it's all a part of that process. So no, you're really hitting the nail on the hammer. And I'm sure a lot of people are feeling what you're saying right now, because this is where a lot of people just are. And especially during the time of the pandemic, you know, everyone needs to be paid, rightfully so, for their services.
Yeah, it's quite, I speak to a lot of different young entrepreneurs and young freelancers that express the same hesitations about, you know, stating your value. And it's just one of those things where you have to reach that frustration point in order to kick it into high gear. And you're like, you know what? No. Just know this is what I'm worth. This is what my hourly rate is. This is what I'm going to charge. They don't like it, they can find someone else. And that's like kind of the attitude of that you need to have. It's like they need me more than I need them, you know?
Absolutely. I love that. No. And this, when you're saying this, I'm in my head, I'm super cringing because I remember like when I first, so I'm a full stack dev, right? So software development is my thing. I love it. But I remember back in the day when, you know, for a one-page website, and even when I fix my lips to say it, it just makes me want to puke. But for a one-page website, I used to charge like $75. And I'm just like, oh my, isn't that crazy? That, exactly. It's ridiculous. Like, I just can't even verbalize how disgusting that makes me feel. But, you know, eventually I got to the point where I was like, wait a minute, I'm doing great work. This makes no sense. This is like literally child, like, I don't know, freaking, I don't know, just not good labor laws. I don't know what to really say it, for lack of better terms. But I don't know. I was probably making 15 cents an hour doing that. But yeah, isn't that crazy? But, you know, but you learn, right, Christina? And I'm sure you have those moments where you probably think about back, you know, before it hits you, like, hey, let me charge. You know, maybe you help someone from ideation stage of a product to launch, and you're like, there's no way on earth that I'd ever charge something like that again. So,
yeah, I do have some cringy moments with like the charging. And then the thing is, like, I had a few like long-term repeating clients as a freelancer. And I remember just realizing the need to raise my rates, yes, like in between projects. So they would come back for another quote or something. And then I was like, oh, you know, like actually I have to charge more. And I, unfortunately, I did lose that one client, like one client due to that. But I mean, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I have to look out for myself too, you know?
Yep. And when people know your value, they're going to invest in it, period. Because when they leave you, they're going to go get a quote from someone else that's similar or maybe more. And guess what? They'll pay it. So,
yeah.
Yep. So now, Christina, yep. I want to know, how did you go from, right, the design, right, that you previously did in your background to specifically 3D printing? And, you know, I know it's not much different, you know, as far as skill set, kind of probably. You know better than me, obviously. But I want to know, is there a particular story behind this that sparked 3D printing?
You know, when I was in college at Pratt, 3D printing existed and there was a lab with a 3D printer and I just refused to use it for the longest time. I think until we started outsourcing it to that company that we later acquired. But I did at that point, I never even operated a machine really. Like I think if I can remember correctly, it feels like forever ago. Like my brain is completely shot from 2020. But if I can remember correctly, I think my partner, Manny, he had a 3D printer, but I just never touched it. Like I just never wanted anything to do with it because it just felt like so complex and it didn't feel like glamorous and it didn't feel like what I went to school for and all this stuff. So I just stayed away from it. And so when we acquired the company, I had to learn really quick how to operate these things. And I think I only had about maybe 8 to 12 hours of training and then that was it. And so I just had to learn from there. But one thing I ended up falling in love with was the logistical aspect of 3D printing and running a service bureau and running a print service. I just love designing process. So even though I'm not designing a product and instead I'm like MakeLab exists to help people launch products, I think of it as in terms of my own business, I'm obsessed with the infrastructure and the process and the flow. Like I can iterate on the system like forever. And ultimately, that's kind of all of my skills in being able to do so in that region, in that like part of the business is because of my academic background in design thinking. It's a really similar process. Anytime you're trying to make something better, it's a really similar process, whether it's a system or like a software, I feel like, or a piece of hardware or a consumer product. Very similar processes when you're designing and iterating. And so that's really what I find is the thread between design and 3D printing.
Now, so for some of our listeners, right, they may not know much about design at all. Can you walk us through what that looks like, right? You talked about design process and infrastructure. What does that look like for you? And I guess that's probably a very generic question because obviously every product isn't the same. But if you could kind of walk us through your mind of how you solve problems in this space.
MakeLab's mission is to make prototyping faster. So the way we fit into working with designers and creatives is, you know, you have a product idea, you start with some research, and then you go into sketching, designing, you may do some 3D modeling, and then somehow you have to bring this thing to life and analyze it from an actual in real life, like 3D perspective. And then you criticize what's wrong with it. You get some feedback from people. And then you're stuck in that loop until you have the final product. So it's like perfecting, you know, your original idea and like making sure it solves all the problems that your research point out as pain points. And so the best where we add value is by making that process faster. So like while they're, say if someone's developing two products, while they're waiting for their 3D printed part to print, they can work on the next thing. So we need to be fast. We need to be on top of it. We need to be organized. That's all fine at a very, very low volume and scale. So if we're just handling like two parts a day and that's all we need to print, that's really easy to manage and you don't really need systems for that. But by the time you're getting to like 50 to 100 parts a day, that's right. Where you really need to have these really smooth systems that are delegatable. You need to have communication systems in place in order for people to talk to each other. And so with that, I always make sure to check in with the daily operations team, even though I'm not running the daily ops. And because of that, I apply that design thinking and I'm like, okay, what are the problems here? Are there any like key performance indicators, KPIs that I can pull from this? And then how do I make it better? And then how, okay, like what's the end goal? And then who do I need to pull into this project? And like what can we do to make this better so we avoid issues? And so that's kind of like the iterative process that is like what I do a lot of.
I love that. I love this process because it can be applied to many different things, right? Not even just developing a physical product, but you even, like you said in the beginning, compared it to, building a piece of software, et cetera, or just projects in general. So that's definitely tangible and something that our listeners can relate to. I'm curious. So you talked about, you had this, you literally get a text, right, from the guy that you met, right? And because I'm like, we can't just bridge, we're not gonna just breeze over that. Like that, first off, that's a big deal to acquire a company. And I kind of want to know about that process of how, the acquisition went, advice you have for other people who are looking into or want to eventually acquire other companies to, expand their own brand. But yeah, I just kind of want to know more about that process. What advice do you have for other folks? And also, please, if you could give context of where you were at that stage when you had that opportunity on the table. And how'd you know it was the right opportunity? So I know that's a lot, but yeah, that's a big deal.
No, it's so true. It's like such a strange way to start out your entrepreneurial journey at like, I don't know, what was I like 20, 24, 25? Like it's insane when I think back on it. I'm like, how the F did I do this? Like, how did we do this? But yeah, I got a text. So we became friends with the owner of the company we acquired. Like Manny and I were a couple, and Rico was the name of the guy running the shop. Him and his wife, they were working together for the company, and so we became friends. They liked our dog. We all went out to pizza. We went out with their kids, and we were just like friends. It was interesting. We were talking about business and just talking about industry, and it was nice to have like that bouncing board support for one another. And then I think the text came in on a Sunday evening, and I was like, I'd like to speak with you and Manny about acquiring our company. And I was like, what? And you asked the question, like, how did you know it was the right opportunity? I actually didn't. This was purely gut feeling. The excitement that I had and the way that my mind was just racing to what could be was an indicator for me that it's worth exploring. And then also, being young, I was like, I to calm the nerves and the anxiety, I was like, if all of this fails, I think I could still get a job somewhere. Like, it's not like this is not going to be fruitful for my career. So I always like thought about like the what if situation, like what if this does fail? Luckily, we haven't had to get there. But yeah, and it was interesting. We didn't know how to go into that conversation. We didn't know what questions to ask. We did a bunch of research. We Googled a bunch of things. We listened to people talk about this process. And of course, like we were operating and acquiring a very, very small business. Like it was just two people, but it was still a business. So we had an attorney that we were working with for like contract work just to shape up our freelance contracts. And so we called her on and to review everything and help us through this. We called on a financial consultant to like help build financial models to analyze profitability and everything. And if we were to take out a loan, like what's the payment plan? Like we just tried our best to get all of our ducks in a row. And then I think it was like 3 months later, we were the owners of the company. Like those 3 months were insane. I don't think I remember much besides like the acquisition.
Yeah, absolutely within itself. And that's amazing. And yeah, you say at the time that business had only two people, but there's a load of other stuff that you're inheriting from this business, from I'm pretty sure intellectual property to their clients to their the stuff that they had previously before. So that's a big deal. And at the time you were 24, 25, like that's a story to be shared. Like, that's a big deal.
That wasn't like thinking, you know, when you're in it, you don't think about the bigger picture and you don't think like as if you're telling the story in third person or whatever. But like saying it here right now, like every time I do like a media opportunity or something, I recount that story and I find I'm remembering more details that make it like super, like, I don't know, abnormal, you know? And I'm just like, whoa, what was I thinking? Like, why I was not a normal 20 something. I'm still 20 something, but like, you know, earlier I wasn't a normal, like, early 20 something year old at all.
No, and but you know what? Those the not normal folks, the folks who aren't the experts in the moment, end up super killing it, right? Because let's say you've been in the industry for 50 plus years and you're like, oh man, this isn't gonna work because of, like you said, age or experience or whatever. And it's just like, you know, I think sometimes going into things blindly helps you to get more done and iterate faster, right? Because you don't know what's blocking you, but when you know the roadblocks that are ahead and you know all the rules and you know been in the industry for X amount of years, I think that you tend to be a bit more apprehensive. And this is also coming from just the other stories of women who've come on the show and who've shared, but that's definitely one of the trends I see is that it's the non-traditional folks who tend to get much further ahead.
I see what you're saying, but I really agree with what you're saying about going into it a little bit naive and blind. I think that is the number one reason why all of this has happened, to be honest. You know, it doesn't always work if you just, if that's all you have, you know, to start a business. There are a lot of other things, but to have that sort of attitude and kind of be ready for anything is so important. And one term that I've always thought about throughout my entire career so far is like fail fast, you know, and fail forward. So learn from everything. Get your failures out of the way. In the design world, they say a phrase is like puke it out, you know, puke out all the things in your head and everything that could be, even if it's a crap idea. Just that's how I like to think about failure. Just like try it all in the beginning, see what sticks and, you know, feel it out, but like stay in tune with it all, but fail fast.
That is, listen, I'm as you're talking, I literally wrote down puke it out. I'm gonna start using it. I've heard, of course, fail fast and fall forward, but I like the that specific. I'm really big on like inspiration and quotes and stuff, but I love the puke it out because, like you said, like sometimes it may be trash, literally, that's coming out, but you know, you just need to get it out because guess what? Sometimes when you puke, you feel better. Right?
Exactly. You don't want to like.
I don't know. Okay, what I was gonna say isn't gonna work, but I was gonna say like it's getting the toxic stuff out so you can focus and you have a clear path. You know what I mean? Just like get it out, identify it as bad, then move on.
That's great. No, I love it, Christina. No, this is great. I'm getting a lot of gems. I'm over here like, let me snap my fingers like this is a poetry jam. This is good. But okay, I'm gonna go into your next question because you seriously, more people need to know who you are. Your story is very, very inspirational based on the stuff that you've already said. But even the next question I have for you, in my research, I found that one of your clients for MakeLab is the National Museum of History and also Away, the travel company. So what does MakeLab do for these two companies? Yeah, that those are two very big like brands in the United States. In a way, I'm pretty sure is a national brand, global brand by now. And I'm obsessed with their founders. The founder story for Away is amazing. So that's amazing that you got to work with them. And yeah, so what does MakeLab do for those two brands?
So for the National Museum of History, they so I guess I should start by like we don't do outbound sales. Like we don't approach people and are like, you should 3D print and you should 3D print with us. Everything that comes in through our self-serving like autoquoter and portal, or it comes through like like an inquiry form. So National Museum of History, they came in through an inquiry form, and they said our contact there had mentioned that they were doing like a spring break workshop. This was last year, pre-COVID, and it was for, I think, I want to say like second graders. And they were learning about dinosaurs. I think there was a big dinosaur exhibit, if I'm remembering correctly. And they wanted to reproduce T-Rex teeth. So they had a model. I think they had 3D scanned something, and they had a model, and they had us print it. One was really large as like a display, and then they had us print smaller ones. So that's what we did. And then I think in casual conversation, I might have followed up, or our project manager at the time might have followed up, but then we were like, oh, this is really cool, you know, just trying to make conversation and see where else we can take it. And they had mentioned, they were like, you know what, would you want to like come in and teach the kids about 3D printing a little bit and like how that can... And they were kind of trying to explore and teach the kids about how archaeology can be intertwined with 3D printing and 3D scanning and all this 3D technology, which obviously it can. It can be used to recreate like accurate parts, which are amazing. So you don't have to, so to like analyze like a set of bones, for example, you wouldn't have to touch the real thing. You can touch plastic and, you know, it's valued at a lot less. So you don't have to worry about breaking it or anything or damaging it in any sort of way. So that's how that happened. And I believe we were in talks to like do it again this year, but then COVID happened. So there are no workshops. And then for Away, same thing. They just came in through our self-serve auto portal, and they're pretty familiar with 3D printing, it seems like, being like a consumer goods product. They probably have used 3D printing in the past. So I actually didn't work directly with the founders. It was our project manager and production team working with the point of contact there who pretty much just submitted the file. But it was pretty cool to, you know, say that Away found us. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's great. Awesome. That's a big deal. And whatever SEO you guys got going on is definitely working. And of course, network too. So that's dope. That's really cool. Christina, I'm curious, right? So 3D printing, I was first exposed to 3D printing when, realistically, I was exposed, I think maybe my sophomore year of high school. So I went to inner city school in on the southwest side of Atlanta. And I remember seeing my very first 3D printer. I went to Georgia Tech for like some internship that they had for the sophomores at the time. And I saw my first 3D printer. I'm like, what in the world is this? And what's coming out of it? And how does all this work? So I'm curious to know, not necessarily that question, but I want to know, what's the largest thing that you've printed with a 3D printer, right? So you talked about this is just a fun question for me, because I'm just like, I'm curious, because I've seen the super small 3D printers, right? And then I've seen 3D printers that I guess they use in, you know, like medical facilities and labs for 3D printing, like, you know, organs and stuff. Like, I've seen documentaries and stuff on that. So, but then I've also seen the YouTube videos of like the 3D printers that are used, I think, in some parts throughout China, for like printing homes in like 24 hours. So like, how big are these things? And, you know, I know they come in different sizes and stuff like that. So I was just curious.
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, with printing houses, those are pretty large, but it also just looks completely different. Like, it looks like a crane arm spitting out concrete. So it's like, it is 3D printing, but it's very, very different than like what we do. Well, obviously, because it's a totally different material and totally different process. You don't need heat. But basically, I'm trying to think. I would say the biggest project we did in size was something that was like 28 inches in diameter. And that was a giant molecule for a medical conference, I think, in late 2018, I believe. Oh, cool. Yeah, that was huge. It was.
If you can like totally email me a picture of that, I would love to see what that looks like. And I'll post it on the podcast website so that the listeners can see it too if they want.
Oh, yeah. I would totally.
But at that time, too, we were also offering different like other services. So we were offering like painting and finishing to make something basically look not 3D printed and just look like perfect plastic or something. And so we had done that with that model. So it's hard to tell that it was 3D printing. It was one of those things where 3D printing is just the way that it was made, but it wasn't like the main story of that item, you know?
Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's like it's like saying something was like injection molded or roto molded. 3D printing is just another way to make something, but because it's so it's accessible and it has the word printer in it, I think it's really easy to assume it can do anything.
Right.
But it is, at the end of the day, it is a manufacturing method. But
right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that, makes sense.
And you know, I want to know, Christina. So in my research about you guys, I've learned that recently in the last few months, MakeLab decided to make a pivot due to the pandemic. And you guys are now kind of focused on creating PPE for frontline workers. So I'm curious, what type of products are you guys making? And what made you guys kind of make this decision to pivot? Because obviously the pandemic's going on, but you could have decided not to do PPE for frontline workers. So what was kind of the inspiration that, you know, impacted MakeLab to do this?
Yeah, so the PPE was a gap filler, not only, hold on one second. So the PPE was not only a gap filler for like the entire healthcare industry, but it was also for us because we did experience a little bit of a loss of revenue for a minute and loss of volume. It wasn't like too long and we've sustained, thankfully, but it wasn't a forever thing. We always knew that PPE was something that was going to last for like 2 to 3 months and like slowly start to die out as regular, like traditional manufacturers were able to pump out PPE like at the normal capacity without being depleted so quickly. So we, I think it was in April 3rd or 4th. I think it was that week that we decided to do it. And we had seen some other companies in the 3D printing industry and community kind of jump to action. And we saw this availability of resources too. So we saw like, we didn't create the file that made the protective face shields. We did modify it a little bit so that we can print it better and faster and optimize our whole production schedule. But it wasn't something that was like too difficult to get started. I think we spent maybe a day or two planning out the entire supply chain and we were able to just get started immediately. And that was like kind of the beauty of 3D printing as a stopgap solution is you can just spring to action real quick. If you have a file, you can throw it all in the printer. And then in terms of the face shields, all that's left to source is the clear visor portion, some foam padding and some elastic. It was so simple. It was great. And so ever since then, PPE, like the demand for PPE has died down quite a bit. I would say in April, it was a higher percentage of our revenue and volume, whereas now it's like in the single digits. It's really not that much, but alongside the face shields, we are also making mask extenders, ear savers, people mm-hmm. are calling them. And then we also made like custom mask fitters that fit over surgical masks. And basically the way that works is you use your iPhone to grab a 3D scan of your face and your profile. And then the app would generate like a custom mask fitter so that it would just ensure like the fit better and close any gaps in surgical masks. So you pay a little bit more for the mask fitter, but you pay a lot less for disposable surgical masks, which was great.
Wow, that's awesome. And you guys developed the app as well for yourself? Or
no, we were actually a production partner for a company called Bellis 3D. And they had worked in the 3D scanning space using iPhones for a little bit. And then when it was really easy for them to adapt to like making PPE and the custom mask fitters because they already had the foundation in place for other products geared towards dentists.
I love to hear about challenges like this, right? Like the pivot stories from founders to me gives me like this sense of just joy, right? Because here it is, this pandemic, revenue goes down, you pivot to a new business model, you make a completely new partnership, right, with this company that is helping with the app and also saving lives in the midst of it all. Like that is pretty rewarding.
Very, very. And it was interesting because like Manny and I were not like, I mean, we were just as panicked too. We were like, what's going to happen? We were bracing for impact. And we just kind of grabbed at something that we thought might work. Like we had no idea if it was going to like help us get through those months or not. We just kind of we're like, well, what else do we have to lose, you know? But I would say one thing about pivoting is it can be very costly. Fortunately, in this case with PPE, it wasn't, at least for us. But one thing I would say is while you're going through it is like you need to always analyze your numbers. Where are customers coming from? What is the new demand? And stay on top of that, because when you're pivoting, things change so quickly. You really need to know and like kind of think back to the customer, like what do they want? Like what would they pay for? And how can I monetize that? So it's like staying in tune with the customer, even if it's a different type of customer. It's just like going through that period of like learning about the customer's habits and like what their needs are on a deep, deep, deep level. And staying on top of that, and that will help guide your decisions. Because if you don't pay attention, I've seen companies like just pivot and not really do the research or not really make the most informed decisions, and it doesn't always work. And you know, earlier I think in Make Labs history, we definitely did that as well. So I think we learned from that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, we all do learn from those moments. But again, these are the moments that can be very, and I guess no pun intended, or maybe it is, but very pivotal, right, in our careers. Like, no, but seriously, right, it's a huge milestone, right, essentially is what I'm trying to say, that can literally make or break a business model. And especially in rare historical moments like pandemics, right, like you kind of have to make a great calculated, you know, look at all your risk, make a great calculated decision so that way you'll survive for the next quarter. So, Christina, you know, can we talk about, you guys also made a recent announcement, where you partnered with Made in New York City to manufacture protective face shields for peaceful protesters in New York City. I thought that when I read that, I was like, oh my goodness, what is the story behind that? You know, and especially as the CEO of the company, you know, of course, obviously you had to make a big visionary decision on this. Yeah. And especially, you know, we're in a very highly political time in this country, in this world in general. But yeah, what was the why behind that? How did that happen? And what kind of impact has Make Lab made?
Oh my gosh, that was such a crazy time. It's still to this day. Manny and I are two diverse founders. In our industry, that is so rare. It is so rare. I'm Chinese. He's Dominican. Like, our team is incredibly diverse as well. But if I look around us, that is so not the case. And so when I first read about and saw on social media and saw some of the video, I couldn't watch it all, of George Floyd and everything that came after, that whole time personally, like, really spoke to me. I think it hit a lot of people really hard, and it really affected a lot of people, and it put into perspective something that maybe was pushed aside before. No, definitely was pushed aside before. Sorry. And it just felt like it was one of those moments where Manny and I were like, no, we have to respond. We have to do something. It's our responsibility. Let's be leaders. Look at our industry. Like, let's talk about it, you know? Like, let's try to contribute. Let's try to do something, not only personally, but with Make Lab as well. And so I wish that we could do more. We're a little limited because we are, like, a bootstrapped small company. But this is something we want to bake into the DNA of Make Lab, like, as we grow. Just a lot more initiative around diversity and inclusion, and just making sure we're being responsible and, you know, standing for what we believe in. And so we made this big announcement on social and in our newsletter and to our customers and everything. And we're like, you know what, like, this is what we stand for. We just took the time to, like, reiterate and rehash, like, our values and state them publicly. And we also participated in Blackout Day. Are you familiar with Blackout Day?
Absolutely. Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we took the day off and we paid everyone. We made it a holiday at Make Lab. because we wanted to be part of that cause. Like, I don't, it's just, like, these social injustices, like, drive Manny and I insane. Like, I can't, like, oh, man. I could really go into it.
It's crazy. Yeah.
And so, you know, we actually attended some of the protests and in the blazingly hot, like, New York summer. And everyone was wearing masks, by the way. It was amazing. It was amazing to see everyone being really responsible with everything. And it was just like one of those amazing moments to be part of something so historical and something that was getting all of this attention. And, you know, it's a movement, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we Made in NYC was doing a call for protective gear for the peaceful protesters. And they actually reached out to us because they had seen our announcement about our just core values and like how we were responding to the whole entire climate at the time. And they asked if we'd be interested in donating like face shields for the peaceful protesters. And we're like, duh, this is amazing. We can help more, you know? And so that's what we did. And it was another one of those like no-brainer situations and decisions. And we were just like, okay, yes. How do we do it? When do you want it? Where can I drop off?
I love this, Christina, for so many reasons. So for one, for me, and of course we understand that this historically in the United States, racial injustice and, you know, white supremacy has been going on for 400 plus years since literally folks touched down in 1619 on this land. But, you know, when the George Floyd video came out, you know, it hit me like it hit when I saw Tamir Rice a couple years ago, you know, the 13-year-old boy who had the play gun at the beach and, you know, the police just came and pulled up and shot him. You know, it hit me the same way with, you know, Trayvon Martin. And for me, it was such an emotional moment. For one, as a Black woman in this country, but two, I felt so powerless because I'm like, here I am working on my tech company in the middle of Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I'm like, this dude just died, right? Like for literally no apparent reason. And so I felt so powerless. And actually that same weekend, my husband and I, we went to the protest. We were at the front. We were standing next to one mother. Her name is Wanda Phillips, and her son was actually brutally abused by some police officers here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And she was at the front of the protest, and she was talking about George Floyd. She talked about the story of her son. And to be there in the moment, I felt like, man, like this is what, you know, they talked about back in the day in third grade when you saw the, you know, the history books of what's going on in 1965 with Dr. King and Bayard Rustin. And right. Like, so to be there in the moment was definitely a beautiful moment, but it was also so sad. And my husband and I, we actually, so we protested that full weekend. You know, we had the full experience from the mace and everything. And I actually haven't publicly said this on the show, so it's coming out now. But that following Sunday, this was in, man, when was this? It feels like it's all a blur. I think this was April or late May. I think it's been May, April, May-ish. But my husband and I actually got arrested and were actually thrown into jail for peacefully protesting. Yeah, so I definitely, when you said, you know, hey, like I had to do something, that was a part of my something, right? Like, okay, yeah, I'm getting arrested, but Breonna Taylor and George Floyd can no longer say their name, so I must continue to do so. And so I just, you know, have to say kudos to you, Christina, and your team for, you know, making a public stance because, you know, and you said you're in your 20s. I know I'm in my 20s, which means we're millennials because the oldest millennial, I think, is like 33. But seriously, what I love about our generation is that even if different people have, a lot of us have different political perspectives and come from different backgrounds, and that's fine. But one thing I do love is that millennials and even the Gen Zers, we're really good with not taking BS and figuring out where do I stand in my calling, right? So, you know, you and MakeLab, you guys make some dope face masks and protective shields for the protesters. You know, there are others of us who are out here protesting, and you guys were out there doing it too. So I just love that our generation is moved by things and we try to do something. We really do.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, it's so different. Like,
it's interesting because our client base spans the whole gamut of ages. Like, we get really young people and we get people that are a little bit older and they're not millennials. And so when we made the social media like announcement and newsletter announcement, we did actually get some backlash from people. They're like, this doesn't belong in business, you know, like, and all this stuff. I was like, no. Times have changed. That is not how it is anymore. If you have a platform, it's time to use it, no matter how big or how small. Like, speak up. And if you're not speaking up, you might as well just not agree with anything and be, you know, there was the whole saying on social media, like, well, I'm not remembering what exactly it was, but it was like, if you're silent, you're the oppressor.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And absolutely. I really felt that, because I'm like, you know, MakeLab has, a pretty good following on Instagram. I have a bit of a following on Instagram. So I was like, you know what? Like, fuck it. Fuck it.
Yeah.
I was never really this outspoken before, but I'm like, I have to. I just have to. Absolutely. I don't know. That feeling was just like so strong, you know, and it still is. It's just.
And you know, and what, because I've seen people post too. They're like, well, why do people post on Facebook and Twitter? It's not doing anything. I'm like, but no, it brings the conversation around. Because think about it. If we have all the powerful founders in technology and all these other industries speaking about it, it's going to inspire our following and their following and their following to do something as well. Mm-hmm. So it absolutely, to even say that, you know, political policy and business don't intersect is a lie, because we see it every day on the news media, no matter what news station, you know, you watch, right? And we know it's the powers that be and the folks who are the business owners and over the banks and the institutions that make things happen. So it's definitely our time, you know, in this world as millennials and Gen Z. I'm always getting on this because that's just who I identify with. But, you know, it's our time to shine. It's our time to speak up. So that was just a beautiful, when I saw that, Christina, I was like, yeah, this is good. And this is going to be a great episode.
So it makes me so happy because, yeah, I mean, I thought about that too. I was like, you know, and I had so many wonderful conversations with people that I hadn't spoken to in like 10 years during all that. And when I was posting on like my personal and for MakeLab and everything and just all of that, like I had a lot of people, a few people come up to me or not come up to me, digitally come up to me, like respond to things and say, you know, like, it's just social media. Like, what are you doing? Like, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, you're right. If it's a platform, it's a platform. Does it make a difference whether it's your Instagram on your feed that you look at every night or if it's the news? Does that take away from the seriousness of it? And I get where other people are coming from. It's like, if you're only doing social media, then what are you really doing? But we were
doing more than just social media.
Absolutely. Yeah. You change lives. And seriously, the work that you guys are doing and, you know, and MakeLab is great. And, you know, I'm pretty sure you're going to have a lot more dope clients. I hope some of the folks who are listening to the show and need some work in 3D printing, that make sure that you guys reach out to MakeLab and you find Christina. But Christina, we're down to our last two questions. And the next question that I have for you is, with all of your knowledge and the mistakes and the successes that you've made over the years, and you've made a lot of success and a lot of failures, right? A lot of mistakes, which we all have. That's why you're successful today. So if you could go back to the beginning of your career / launch of your company, you know, what advice would you give yourself?
So recently I've always been kind of shy, and I think with any founder or any leader or like anytime you're doing something new that maybe not everyone approves of because it's a risk, you're kind of afraid to be loud and proud about it because you're like, and you're afraid to receive backlash. You like don't know how to deal with it. And it wasn't until this year that I was like, again, I was like, fuck it. Fuck it. Maybe my experience can inspire someone or speak to someone like experiencing something similar at that time. I don't know. Maybe, like, why not share? And I wish that I had started doing that a lot earlier, because not only is it a point of reflection for me to talk about these things, but it also creates, like, purpose, you know, because you move so fast as a founder, as an entrepreneur, that, like, you kind of can't keep up with yourself. And so just having these moments where you can like pause, like have a conversation, whether it's on social media, at a networking event, conference, you know, whatever, just pausing for a minute to expand and share is one of the most useful and helpful things. And I think one of the ways you can really love yourself during this really difficult journey. And I just wish I would have done this earlier because I think it would have helped me a lot. But I was so shy. You know, my mom was worried about me starting my own business and quitting my job with the freelancing. So, you know, like I just felt like I was still the black sheep of the family and I shouldn't be talking about it, but I wish I had just said F it and just been loud and proud.
But you're doing that now. And I really can't wait to see the trajectory of where you'll be. Shoot, a year, 2 years, 3, 5, 10 from now, you're going to freaking kill it. So you're don't beat yourself up. You're doing a phenomenal job. And you know what too, like, you know, now, but that's also a really dope part of your story too, Christina, because there are a lot of folks who are like that. Right. Like they're like, even hearing your story right now, I bet you there's someone listening like, wait, what? She was shy. Like she didn't want to talk. Like, but there are a lot of millions of people around the world who feel that way. And so, yeah, maybe, you know, the wish is, I wish I would have started earlier, but now your story, I just say your story is more relatable. That's how I look at it. You had to go through that.
I see what you're saying. You have a point. You have a point. But yeah, it's so weird. Like thinking back, like I was even like kind of like intimidated by Twitter for the longest time until like very, very recently, like maybe a month ago, I started using Twitter. I had a profile and I like never touched it. And I just started using it. And I was so like with Instagram, you can put photos and like that's what the platform calls for. But for Twitter, it's like opinions, you know, so it's like putting that shit on blast. And it's so intimidating. And the only reason why, one of the reasons why we started doing it, or I started doing it, was because we're raising capital this year. So I wanted to kind of understand like how the world of VC and like how people talk and like, I don't know, trends in the market from the financial side of things and the investing side of things. And it was, yeah, it was, that was an interesting process too. And that was literally just a month ago, but yeah, it's interesting.
That's awesome. No, I love it, Christina. No, you're good. And no, let me tell you, Twitter is intimidating to anyone. I mean, I heard someone say last week, they were like, I follow a lot of developers who are like coders and stuff. And they're like, if you ever want to know if your code sucks, just make a tweet about it. And you'll find all these random, like people trolling your code, like post a picture of your code. And it can get pretty brutal on Twitter. Like that, even I'm like, I need to be careful what I say, because people are literally waiting to attack you.
Oh my gosh, that's terrifying.
Yeah, it is terrifying. But you know, you just kind of, the other part of me is like, you know what? Like there's some people who may, I've said some stuff and people make comments. And it's like, oh wait, like I actually don't have to respond to you. So
I know. And that's the other thing too, is like with Instagram too, I would feel all this pressure to respond to everyone.
Everybody. Yeah.
Right. It's good. It's good to be like, you know what? There's some separation here. This is a screen. This is my phone. I can walk away from my phone. So let me walk away from my phone.
Absolutely. You got to have some good balance. You have to.
Yeah.
So Christina, for the last question, I would say it's the most important question that I ask every single guest at the end of the show. What's one tangible thing or resource that you can share with our listeners today?
I would say find role models. That is so helpful. I feel like, well, no, I know that the entrepreneurial journey can be very lonely. It's like when you're in your head and you don't, maybe your friends aren't into it and they're working in different careers, and this takes up a lot of your time, more than just the 40-hour work week. So it can become really isolating, you know? And then once you start to see how the world works through an entrepreneur's eyes, it's really hard to not see that. So it's harder to be present during moments that you are with friends or family, you know? And that can be really isolating and not healthy. So I would say always find role models. I love following like communities. I follow Sophia Amoruso. I follow Sarah Blakely. I follow Christine Souffron and Tim. She was one of my first like role models in business. She was like, if you don't know her, look her up. She's amazing. At the time in 2016, she put on this like free business boot camp and she did a tour around the nation with it. And it was completely free, like all day. And she brought in all these investors and like all these people that just like dished out the real talk, you know, nice. It's like, this is how you get PR. This is how you organize. Use Evernote, blah, 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 blah. It was like a crash course into how managing productivity and like how that helps your business. And it was amazing. I came home and I was talking to Manny, and my brain was exploding and I was like so inspired. And so find people that incite that in you and follow them, follow their content, and that will help a lot.
That's amazing. Well, Christina, I know that folks who are listening to the show, you're going to be their role model and folks that they're looking up to. So what are the ways that people can follow you and stay in contact? Is there a newsletter for MakeLab? All the good stuff.
Instagram for now. I'm pretty Instagram and Twitter, I would say. Twitter I'm still like warming up to, but on those two platforms. Oh, and LinkedIn. I've been posting more on LinkedIn too. Okay. So Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn, I have started to post more things that are just along the lines of providing value to others that might be experiencing similar things and just points of reflection and little tips here and there. I would say those are the ways. I think one day, maybe down the line when things aren't as crazy, I'd love to like start a newsletter and I don't know, be more active with my own like personal brand to help. I think I was just talking about it with Manny, but like my dream in life would be to become like, and this is still in its formative stages, so this might change, but my dream is to just become like, I don't know, like an angel investor of some sort later in life where I can really get in on the ground and like help others start their businesses. I just love the idea of that. That like really excites me. And so I want to start that, but like
I'm doing a lot already. So
right. Absolutely. One day at a time. The balance. I love it. Well, everyone, this was Christina Perla, CEO and founder of MakeLab. Christina, it was such a pleasure to have you on the show today. Everyone who's listening, thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Women in Tech with Ariana. It's your favorite podcast host signing out, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.